We kick off hour number two of the program. This segment brought to you by the official credit union of 3 and Out. It is the Knoxville TVA Employees Credit Union, and you can get all the details about their services at tvacreditunion.com. They're celebrating 85 years in East Tennessee, helping their members grow financially, moving upward and forward with the Knoxville TVA Employees Credit Union. They'd love to help you do the same as well. All the services of a bank, but with the benefits of a credit union, of course. Celebrate Christmas in July right now with a Christmas Club savings account, where they can help you out with all those other credit union services. TVACreditUnion.com. That's TVACreditUnion.com. Or if you walk into a branch, tell them you heard about them right here on 3 and Out and Fox Sports Knoxville. They'd love to add you as one of their loyal members that they treasure so dearly at the Knoxville TVA Employees Credit Union. Talking some Tennessee football. 24/7 Sports says Tennessee is the fourth most likely sleeper heading into the season.
So they had this in January, and then the FPI has Tennessee at 9-3 last week.
Yeah. TCU was one. I want to get to two in a minute. Nebraska was three. I've seen Nebraska be way high in some people's just like polls that aren't analytics based. They're just going to go with the Scott Frost big year two step forward. He's got a quarterback, obviously, and Adrian Martinez.
I have a question.
Yes.
What are they basing off, like, the name sleeper? So Tennessee 5-7, does that, if they go 7-5, does that mean they were a sleeper? If Nebraska wins 8 games, does that mean that they were a sleeper?
I don't know how to answer this question because they don't really answer it themselves.
So just teams that are probably going to improve.
They're going to be better than people think.
This is what constitutes a sleeper for the 2019 season. For this exercise, we've chosen a group we expect to be outside the preseason top 20 in August, not considered one of the elites, at least not perceived that way heading into openers. For reference, we've included where we expect each of these teams to be ranked in the AP top 25. So I get they don't really define, they define why they're allowed to pick these teams, but not how good they need to be, you know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They don't, to jump. They don't answer their own question here. They don't tell you what constitutes each team being a sleeper and what, you know, exceeding expectations would look like on a team-by-team basis.
I would expect, because they've said inside the top 20 would be non-sleeper status, that they're saying these are teams that will be outside the top 20 before the year that could finish inside the top – that would have the ability to finish inside the top 20.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't say that, though.
That's kind of weird.
Tennessee, though, fourth best sleeper in the country. Whatever that means.
I mean, if you're only picking teams outside the top 20, I mean, that basically means they think Tennessee's going to be somewhere between 21 and others receiving votes. You know, that Tennessee's going to be in that range, if you're kind of
maybe
projecting. Number two is Missouri.
It's weird to me that a team can be considered a sleeper when they can't do anything in the postseason.
Well, I saw a
also
tweet.
They're really not. I mean, people expect them to have a pretty good year. The FPI has them going 8-0 to start the year.
Right. Like, I would say if Missouri was a sleeper, they would have won the East. Or am I putting them way too high?
Last year or this year?
This year? Like, yeah, in order for me to be like, oh, yeah, I slept on Missouri, they won the East. Like, if they win 8 or 9 games, like you
well,
said.
Well, I mean, like, Kentucky last year definitely exceeded expectations and didn't win the East. But Missouri this year is probably a better team heading into the season than Kentucky was last year. So I'd buy that. I think if Missouri's right there, I mean, obviously they can't win it, but if they're in the hunt for the East late in the year, you know, theoretically, even though they can't win it, yeah, I'd say wow, better year than I thought. Of course, I'm going the other way. I think they're kind of overhyped and overrated. I don't think that team can sustain under Todd Odom what they're hoping they can.
Isn't it weird that, I mean, people pick these like sleeper teams a lot of times based on the schedule. So like that was kind of their point. Well, Missouri might, like you said, the FBI, they might start 8-0. But it's mainly not because they're so much better than we think they are. It's just because they have a great chance to win all those games because they don't play anybody that's really good.
Maybe it's you kind of see Missouri right now as a 6-6, 7-5 team, but because of the schedule, they're actually capable of doing, you know, 8, 9, 10 wins, whereas you didn't see that. So kind of like Kentucky last year.
Yeah, we do have to separate how good we think a team is and how good we think they'll do in the season because of the schedule. Those two things have to be.
And I guess what you just defined. Like what you kind of just in your mind's eye view that team as a program
all the time.
Like,
yeah.
Oh yeah, Missouri this year. Yeah, they'll you're 7-5, 8-4. But if they go 10-2, obviously they've been slept on and exceeded expectations. If the over-under for Vegas is 6.5, if Tennessee wins 8 or 9 games, I would say that puts them in the they-got-slept-on category. They were much better than people thought. West Virginia last year, I guess you could technically categorize them as a sleeper. Their over-under was, what, 7? And they won 10 or 11 games. So I guess that's kind of the math we're looking at. And obviously this was written in January, and recent data and analytics and formulas have said, yeah, Tennessee actually does have a pathway to potentially 9 wins, maybe 10 if the ball bounces the right way. I'm just saying, one bounce, change the game. I mean, that goes both ways. I'm just being positive.
Somebody was tweeting the other day that Missouri could face a postseason ban. I think their appeal is in progress.
I thought it got upheld, but maybe it didn't.
I don't know.
Maybe that's not finalized yet.
It would be it would be peak, you know, non blue blood SEC team to like win the East in a year when you can't like if somehow
Tennessee,
Georgia,
as long as
Florida
Tennessee
fall
beats
apart,
them winning the East would be kind of awesome. Just saying, to win it and then not be able to go,
yeah,
that would be classic Missouri. I mean, at least the way I view Missouri.
In the write-up here, they talk about how, at best, Missouri will be picked 3rd in the East at Media Days. So I think they're categorizing them as being a sleeper if they're able to somehow finish ahead of either Florida or Georgia.
Sure, yeah.
in the East.
I buy that. And then Tennessee, probably going to be projected. Can Tennessee get to 5th, you think?
In the vote?
Mm-hmm.
Media vote?
Mm-hmm. Vanderbilt's going to be picked 7th because it's Vanderbilt. They're always picked 7th.
I think, yeah.
Is it Tennessee
next? I think
there
could be a lot of split votes in the middle of the pack, right?
Right, yeah. Like South Carolina, Tennessee, and Kentucky are probably all going to just be stealing votes from each other. So I wonder if some of this preseason hype maybe.
The power of the T kind of rises them above the other two.
Perhaps. I mean, if they get picked 4th in the East, I won't be upset by that. I think they could easily get picked 4th and then exceed expectations by finishing 3rd, maybe 2nd with an outside shot.
I think Kentucky gets preseason 6.
6?
So it goes Vandy, Kentucky, and then, like you
probably
said.
Probably Tennessee.
Tennessee, South Carolina right there.
Missouri, 3.
Okay. Yeah, I think that probably makes most sense.
Well, and if people – that's what's tricky about standings, too. Like the writers are technically trying to pick what's going to happen, not how good they think the teams are. So you
correct.
Bump Missouri up because they're easy schedule.
Yeah.
Right? So they'll be 3rd for sure.
And South Carolina's going to take a hit because they got Alabama.
Yeah.
You know, this
and
year.
And A&M.
Right. Well, they have A&M every year. I'm just saying Alabama coming on the schedule this year, that's a guaranteed loss for South Carolina.
So
obviously, the Clemson game doesn't matter, and it's the last game of the season, so it doesn't impact any other games. But if you're talking national finish, that's probably going to impact South Carolina in a big way. They could still be a pretty good team. They just have basically 3 guaranteed losses right now.
Wasn't there over-under like 5.5?
Yeah, it was low. It was really low. Surprisingly low.
Yeah.
Like what? It's weird, right? Because I think on our unofficial record season prediction at 7-5.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't know. Is that my expectation? Like it's weird because I guess there's this weird divide between like hope, expectation, and bare minimum.
Mm-hmm.
But if I say 7-5, for me to be a sleeper, like that doesn't include Tennessee being a sleeper. That just includes them being about as good as I think they're going to be. So I guess for me to be a sleeper team, Tennessee needs to go 8-4 or 9-3 if I'm at 7-5. you're at 6-6, so 8-4 for you, you're thinking, wow, what a year. And then 9-3 obviously is, yikes, great job, Jeremy Pruitt.
Yeah.
Roll out the extension.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. 9-3, yeah.
I think most people would be pretty happy with that. But it is weird that there's such a divide still with FPI at 9-3. Tennessee's one of the, you know, sleeper teams in the country. And maybe we need to throw away FPI as this, like, widely accepted and known formula. I would imagine there's a lot of people with votes of some kind, college writers, college football fans, that don't know about the FPI, that don't know Tennessee's going to be projected to go 9-3 according to those data points. So maybe somewhere in the 7-5 to 9-3 range is considered sleeper. I mean, like, if Tennessee goes 6-6, I'm not thinking anybody in the country is saying, ooh, wow, Tennessee really exceeded expectations this year. What a sleeper. Unless two of your six wins are over, you know, Georgia, Florida, or Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a question of who else did you lose to, and how can you be a sleeper if you're losing to bad teams? But it's strange, this hype. And it's not even just a, you know, big net that they're throwing over Tennessee football and saying could be pretty good. It's like individuals on the team that when Pro Football Focus does their snap-by-snap grade, you're like, whoa, wait, huh? What is this? I mean, Darrell Taylor is the fourth highest-rated senior linebacker slash edge rusher in the country, statistically. A lot of people are thinking he's going to be pretty good. You've got two really good corners, obviously. Bryce Thompson and Alante Taylor graded out very, very high last year. I think you feel pretty good about safety. You've got a lot of young talent at linebacker. But offensively, guys like Jarrett Garantano, Ty Chandler, did you see the Ty Chandler stat as far as the passing game is concerned? I have a lot of questions about that.
I did.
For Tyson Helton, but that is an exciting revelation to think, with Jim Chaney and a guy who knows what he's doing, this could be pretty damn dangerous. And not to mention the Jarrett Garantano stuff, which blew my mind yesterday in that ESPN Insider article.
We'll get into those numbers next. You don't want to miss it. Stick with us right here as we talk Tennessee football on Fox Sports Knoxville. Welcome back into the Fan Run Studios, Fox Sports Knoxville. Talking Tennessee football. Pro Football Focus is a company that started by grading every NFL player every single play. They give a plus minus per play. Zero is you did your job like an average player would at your position for that play. A lot of times guys get zeros just when they do normal stuff and really aren't the focal point. For example, if a quarterback hands the ball off on a run play, I mean, they're just going to get a zero for that. I mean, every time, unless they like fumble it or go the wrong way or something, you know, really awful. Pro Football Focus has started doing college grading as well. However, I still don't think you can just subscribe as a normal person, get an account, and look at every single player in college and their grades. I wonder if that's because I really don't know what the reason is exactly, but I wonder if that's because they might still get some really crazy outliers in their college football grading. Because if you've ever tried to play like college fantasy football, you know it's kind of tough when you've got, you know, Navy, old school Navy out here running the football a million times a game, all the way to, you know, Hawaii throwing it every play or whatever. But the Pro Football Focus college account will tweet out their ratings and different grades and different statistics, you know, throughout the year and the off season. And that account tweeted this out recently, yesterday at 11:13 a.m. When it came to catching out of the backfield, no one in the SEC was better than Ty Chandler. He averaged 8.6 yards after the catch per reception and turned in 3 touchdowns through the air. Highest receiving grades among SEC running backs last year, minimum 15 targets. Ty Chandler, 86.7. DeAndre Swift of Georgia was second, 81. 5.5.
I mean, we all knew he was really good catching the ball last year. Mm-hmm. He only caught passes in 4 games. He caught 19 passes combined, 183 yards. That's 9.6 per catch, 3 touchdowns, long of 42. 7 passes against South Carolina, 3 against Alabama, 5 against Auburn, 4 against Georgia, none in any other game. If I'm Jim Chaney, I'm licking my chops at the thought of Ty Chandler catching passes from Jarrett Garantano, especially with this offensive line and kind of not knowing, at least yet, how good they can be.
Yeah.
Talk about a safety valve. Also, it allows Jim Chaney to do what he does best, which is some nifty motions and getting guys isolated against players that he knows they can beat. He's done this everywhere he's been. You know, all the different things he did with Cordarrelle Patterson. I'm not necessarily comparing Ty Chandler to Cordarrelle Patterson from a skill standpoint. I'm just saying a weapon who can do different things. Excited to see now what Jim Chaney does, realizing, because he didn't need this stat. I'm sure Jim Chaney went back and watched all of Ty Chandler's catches in those 4 games and said, why did this guy not catch more passes? Why was this not a focal point? This is something that Jim Chaney could take and work with. I foresee now a lot of 2-back sets in the shotgun and Ty Chandler probably motioning out to the slot more times than he had catches last year. That's just what Jim Chaney does. I don't know like what Ty Chandler's ceiling is as a collegiate running back, but getting him involved in the pass game is how you get him to that point. He's a good runner between the tackles. He's a better runner outside the tackles. And I think he's probably a better pass catcher than any of that. This is where you can really exploit some mismatches or at least spread defenses out a little bit to maybe take one guy out of the box and put Jeremy Banks with less people trying to tackle him. You got 2 backs. You slide Chandler out. And then Jarrett Garantano, and this is just a guess here, makes a quick read. If the guy's 10 yards off of Chandler, snap, catch, I think you called it smoke, just get it to Chandler, mm-hmm. Let him make a juke, get 8, 9, 10, or more yards, and then if the numbers align in the box, you just hand it off to Big Banks, Tim Jordan, and go to town. Eric Gray also going to be a really good pass catcher. That's one thing he does extremely well. This might not be an offense that looks similar to what we saw last year, but it may be something that is infinitely more productive thanks to Jim Chaney and the weapons he has to work with. I'm starting to think maybe there's a little bit more explosion offensively than we are thinking exists. And that's because the offense was so enigmatic last year, and frankly, a lot of times it was just dead. If Jeremy Pruitt isn't forcing Jim Chaney to hand it off on first and second down every single time, and we can utilize guys like Chandler in the pass game, utilize Dominic Wood Anderson a little bit more, I think you feel pretty good about your first 3, 4, 5 receivers. If that offensive line is improved at all, this is not that bad of a situation from a skill player standpoint, in my opinion. It's not Bama, it's not Georgia, but these are guys that can make plays and have made plays at the SEC level, especially Ty Chandler. I mean, you look at who he caught touchdowns against. It was Auburn, it was Georgia, and it was Alabama. It's 3 pretty talented defenses that he's, you know, cooking. And again, the 42-yarder against Auburn, that was they got him in the slot, they got him ISO'd, he jukes the pants off of I don't know if it was a safety, linebacker, or corner, he runs the quick slant, he's wide open in the middle of the field, Garantano hits him, he just turns, and there's nobody there. And he outruns and kind of splits the safeties up the field. I mean, I knew he was a good pass catcher. I didn't realize he would have such a grade as far as, you know, catching it when it's thrown to him and then what he did after the catch. 8 yards is what you said after the catch? Like
8.6, yeah.
That's really, really good. And he only averaged 9.6 per catch. So he's that tells me that he's catching it short and then making something happen almost every single time.
It's not inflated by, you know, two deep 35-yard wheel routes or anything like that. I mean, he was having to do – I mean, we know there wasn't time to get a running back down the field last year in the offense. These were short throws that he was able to get in space
and I think
make
that's a good point by you. Like, it's inflated because one of these is 42 yards, but he caught that ball 5 yards down the field, right? Like, the 35-yarder against Georgia – that one may have been a deep shot, kind of over the top, if I'm not mistaken, but that's one play.
Right.
And I think that was one where we did exactly what we said Tyson Helton should do all season and motion. I think he even motioned him way out wide or to the slot, and he actually did run a wheel route. But the one against Auburn, that was just getting open, catching a short pass, and bursting up the field.
Well, and I hope that these passing numbers actually can translate more to the running game, too. I mean, if Ty Chandler's able to get more space to get to the second level on some more runs this year, don't we think that the fact that he's so dynamic in space after he's caught the ball, that should translate to being dynamic in open space when you're running the ball? I just felt like last year, you didn't have open space in the run game, like, ever.
No.
You know, like, one toss sweep against, like, the worst team on your schedule. That's, like, the only play that comes to mind as, like, a long run to me. Anything else that was, like, a long
run...
And
it was Ty Chandler.
Was only because the defense kind of like just busted something. And even then, like, you know, like it just, that's why this season and expectations and all this sleeper and hype and all that's so hard to project, because there's so much room for improvement. I mean, they were so bad in some areas last season. Like, on the one hand, as you look at it optimistically, you're like, there's no way it's going to be that bad. There's just no way. And then we've got some of these good things to look at, then all of a sudden the FBI has you at 15. That's how it happens.
I'll take it. Obviously, a lot of this hinges on the offensive line. I'd say they shoulder most of the expectation as far as getting better and making this offense worth a damn.
And they also fall into the category of there's no way they'll be worse than last year. No way.
I feel like we've said that before, and it hasn't necessarily been true, but I'm going to agree with you because
on this one,
they have to be better. But the lightning rod, and I guess it's because the offensive line is obviously a collective. It's a group of five.
Yeah.
So you can't blame one single individual as being the, you know, the crux of the situation. So mm-hmm. Will Friend catches a lot of heat, but obviously it was year one, so people are a little bit more lenient on coaches. But the lightning rod for this team this offseason, and really for the last 2 years, has been Jarrett Garantano. ESPN is all in on Jarrett Garantano. They say he is a player that is on the verge of a breakout season, that he is primed and ready to be the five-star dual-threat quarterback that's no longer a dual threat when we signed him out of high school. The answer, you might be surprised to learn, is Tennessee's Jarrett Garantano, who threw only 3 interceptions in 246 attempts, despite playing behind one of the country's worst offensive lines. Okay, one more quiz question. Who had the better season? Player A, 59.4% completion, 7.8 yards per pass, 3.4-1 TD to interception ratio, 35% conversion on third downs, or player B, 62.2% completions, the same 7.8 yards per pass, 4-1 TD to interception ratio, and 41% conversions on third downs. Pretty close, but you'd probably give the nod to player B, right? Well, once again, that's Jarrett Garantano. The other player, Oregon's Justin Herbert, the number one quarterback on your draft boards for 2020. Obviously, Herbert threw more touchdowns, and he threw for more yards.
Mm-hmm.
He also threw it about twice as many times. I mean, I realize we couldn't call more passes last year, right? Because
I think we could have and we should have, but
well,
we didn't do it.
They didn't because they didn't want to get him killed. I think really the South Carolina game, you saw the game plan, at least more of what should have been going on the whole time, which was the quick passing game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. And then against most teams, not named South Carolina, because they had really good safety and corner play, you get those deep shots after you set up the short stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I realize it. He threw it less. But if you extrapolate the data, like, Garantano was better than Herbert against a much tougher schedule with an offensive line that was boo-boo. Maybe, and I understand it. Like, I get why fans would be less than excited about Jarrett Garantano based on some things you saw last year. And this is what we've kind of been saying, and certainly what I've been saying this offseason is, if everything around him, and that includes coaching, raises, I mean, we've seen trashy quarterbacks in college football and in the NFL have a lot of success because they've got a great running game to lean on. They've got a great offensive line, a super tight end, two really good receivers. Like, it becomes easier. I think Eli Manning is a pretty good example. When the right things are around him, he can be serviceable. And then everything else just kind of takes off because he's facilitating.
Well,
can Garantano do that? And can everybody else be that much better to allow it to happen?
I know Billy's high on Garantano. I want to get his thoughts on the flip side. And also, you know, I mean, a lot of this has to do, a lot of quarterback stats and quarterback success has to do with the system and who's calling the plays and how it's structured. And we know all that's changing. So it's probably good news. We'll chew on a little more next. Stick with us right here on 3 and Out. Welcome back into the Fan Run Studios, Fox Sports Knoxville. Talking quarterback play, Tennessee football. ESPN Insider article, super high on Jarrett Garantano. Under the radar players ready for a breakout season.
Get excited yet?
Well, I love talking about this stuff because there's no more evidence of good coaching than how your offense runs. Like, offensive coaching is a true measure of, you know, the brilliance of how to kind of scheme almost like it's chess, but also be able to relate to actual, you know, human beings and people, and then how they relate to others on the field, especially now that the passing game is the most efficient way to get the ball down the football field. I mean, I remember watching Houston.
You watch me?
When Tom Herman was there playing Greg Ward at quarterback, who was a wide receiver like the year before, or maybe 2 years before. It might have been that first game they're playing Oklahoma. And I'm like, they have a receiver playing, a former receiver playing quarterback, and this offense is moving the ball down the field against, and that was before Oklahoma's defense really fell apart in terms of, like, you know, the whole theme lately. Like, it kind of goes, maybe it's the underdog in me. Like, I always love watching untalented, when compared to their opposition, offenses be able to find ways to move the football against defenses that should be able to shut them down. Now, Tennessee was kind of the exact opposite of that last year in a way, but they also were they were out-talented in a lot of these games where they didn't move the football at all. You know, the Tennessee offense had less talent than the Alabama defense, for example, or the Georgia defense, for example. I mean, we know this. There are players on this offense that have talent. But last year, especially when you looked at certain positions like offensive line, you know, you were way behind the eight ball there. And I felt like the mistake Jeremy Pruitt made, and I don't know if he'd admit it or not, but he kind of tried to install big boy SEC offense just like right out of the gate.
Do you think that was the plan all along, or do you think he realized what Tyson Helton wanted to do and said, no, we're not doing all this, let's cut it in half? And the other half will now be a power run game. Like, I'm wondering if maybe I don't know what that conversation looks like. But typically you go to an offensive coordinator and you find something that you like, right? And you go with it. Tyson Helton ran the ball more last year than he has anywhere else he's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't seem like it was his idea. And we've heard, you know, there was some communication in game and in the meeting room leading up to games about what the offensive game plan was going to be on a given night. So was this a case of Jeremy Pruitt? Was it a bad fit, or was it a just bad all around because it wasn't a good fit, and then you didn't let the guy do what he wanted to do? Because I think we agree, like, some of the concepts last year were good, but it all looked janky. Like, nothing ever gelled. There was not an identity. And whether you like what an offensive coordinator is doing or not, typically they have an identity.
I think Tyson Helton was appealing to Jeremy Pruitt on the front end because when they met and talked, Tyson Helton probably impressed Pruitt by his ability to know all kinds of different multiple offensive styles and formations and identities. And then when Jeremy Pruitt said, okay, yeah, I want to hire you, and this is what I want from my offense. I mean, we even heard Tyson Helton in some of the interviews say, like, you know, well, there's things I like to do and things I like to do more than others. But, you know, I'm a multiple kind of guy, and I'm obviously going to do what my head coach wants. So I think Tyson Helton, if he was just turned loose on his own, would have run this offense a lot differently. But I don't think that means Jeremy Pruitt was telling him what he had to do. I think Tyson Helton just tried to design an offense he thought Jeremy Pruitt would be happy with. And
he's an unproven coordinator, so that would – I mean, that would add up. That would make some sense.
He was trying to please his head coach, and I think Pruitt probably did say a few things like, hey, just keep in mind, you know, we're pretty thin, and we're, you know, on defense, we need to try and protect those guys. We need to try and, you know, stay on the field on offense. And so Tyson Helton, you know, designed an offense that huddled, that took time to do that, that, you know, checked over with the sidelines, try and get in the best plays, an offense that tried to be conservative and stay on the field, and it just didn't work. I mean, Jeremy Pruitt even admitted that when Tyson Helton called a play he didn't like and it worked, he was the happiest he could be. I mean, I think Jeremy Pruitt
reverse against Kentucky is when he said that.
I think Jeremy Pruitt wanted success over everything, but I think Tyson Helton, in his yearning to try and please his head coach as he tried to create an offense that would be successful, just completely missed the mark. And Jeremy Pruitt, being a defensive guy, wasn't able to jump in and save it at any point during the season. And so then, you know, the change to Jim Chaney makes sense. It's like, okay, let's bring in a guy that isn't a first-time guy, won't have to feel like he needs to make me happy, and I can just say, hey, I think Jeremy Pruitt gave Tyson Helton very loose guidelines, and Helton might have taken them even too much to the extreme. But again, like you said, there's no way to know because we don't know what happened with all these theories.
It's just weird to me that you go and look at what Tyson Helton did at – now, granted, this is obviously a different conference, different level of football, but what he did at Western Kentucky was just chuck the ball around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his first year calling plays at Western, Brandon Dowdy throws for 4,800 yards and almost 50 touchdowns.
Goodness.
The next year, they were top 10 in total yards, passing yards, scoring, and passing efficiency. Like, Tyson Helton's a guy who just wants to fling it around the field. So, if you're Jeremy Pruitt, you had to have known that as you researched what the guy's done in the past. So that's my question. Was this Jeremy Pruitt saying, hey, I like your passing stuff, we got to get a running game to go with it, and Tyson Helton's just not as good in the running game, so we didn't – was it too base? Was it too simple? Does he not understand the cat-and-mouse chess game that is involved when running the football? Or was it Jeremy Pruitt sitting back and saying, power eye up the middle two times, we'll see what we get? That's what I don't know. But none of it really matters because now it's Jim Chaney. And whether or not Jeremy Pruitt was telling Tyson Helton what to do or Tyson Helton wasn't good at it, we know he's probably not going to tell Chaney what to do. He's going to trust him. And we know that Jim Chaney has a big old track record for success in this conference and other conferences. He's good with quarterbacks. He's good with receivers. He's improved offensive lines everywhere he's been. And he's a guy who figures out what his team can do and sticks to it. Hey, we've got these great running backs. Let's just pound it down people's throats. Hey, we've got a quarterback and a bunch of really fast, tall receivers. Let's sling it 40 times a game. So I think Jim Chaney, and this is one of the things we've said about him since he was a long shot candidate, right, in the coaching search, was the good thing about him is he's proven he can do it any way he can.
Yeah.
Like whatever cards he's dealt, he knows how to play them to win or, you know, to be successful on offense. I'm saying winning on offense because the defense obviously plays a big part in that.
Right.
But based on what I'm seeing when I look at Tennessee's roster, I like the weapons that Jim Chaney has. I'm hopeful, though, that Jeremy Pruitt allows Jim Chaney to do what Jim Chaney does. And I think Jim Chaney could be a really big benefit to a guy like Will Friend, again, because of experience, not only as an offensive coordinator, but just in this league when it comes to offensive line play. Like, if it doesn't work for Will Friend, if there's not vast improvement this year on the offensive line under Will Friend, it probably just isn't going to happen. They have to be better. And as you said, they can't really be worse, but they really need to be big-time better. Like, better. If you have the experience now of the guys you return, 2 5-star freshmen coming in who aren't your typical freshmen, right? They're more game ready than most. If you have all of that and Jim Chaney, a guy who's done this before, and the offensive line is still woeful, sorry. Like, you're out and we're gonna go get Sam Pittman.
There's a good question on Twitter about Chaney and some of the biggest games of the year. We'll hit that on the flip side. Stay on this topic. If you want to weigh in, give us a shout. 865-546-8200 is the number to call in. You know, what do you how big of a difference do you think there'll be between Tyson Helton last year, Chaney this year? What does it mean for Tennessee's offense? And Billy's got some really good statistics on Chaney, his other stops, and how teams have improved there on the offensive side of the football. All that coming up next right here on 3 and Out. Final segment, hour number two. Got a good question on Twitter, and you can give us a call, 865-546-8200. Weigh in on this one, or just in general. Tyson Helton versus Jim Chaney. What does that mean for Tennessee's offense in 2019? I mean, I think we all expect improvement. It's more how much and what does it look like. The question on Twitter is, speaking of offensive schemes, do you feel better or worse having Chaney against Alabama? He's come up short in the past couple years. For the record, he's an enormous upgrade, but it's an interesting question. Has he really come up short against Alabama, or has just Georgia come up short against Alabama? Now, I know they could have scored a little more in either one of those games.
They could have stopped them a little more, too.
And won, but, you know, 4th and 11 was the punt team that didn't make it and the call to even try that, and if my memory serves, 2nd and 26 was the Georgia defense that gave up the game-winning touchdown. I mean, in fact, like Georgia was ahead. What didn't hadn't Blankenship hit like a 50-some-odd yard field goal in overtime to give them the 3-point lead?
Something like that
in the first half of that OT, and then Alabama hits the touchdown for the win. So, like, I mean, you could criticize, I guess, that they didn't score a touchdown themselves in overtime. But I'll give you credit for this. You said it immediately during the break as we were reading this. Georgia's the one team that has consistently scored on Alabama recently. No one else can even score.
The last 2 years, they've put up the second highest point total against Alabama in both years.
Both seasons, right?
They scored 23 in the championship game. Obviously, that one was in overtime. The highest that year that Alabama surrendered was on the road at Mississippi State, where they gave up 24.
What's the score in that game, though?
31-24.
Okay.
So that one, I think Mississippi State scored 2 late touchdowns in that one.
I don't remember that game being close, so that's why I asked.
And then last year, last year I guess there were technically 2 teams. Georgia scores 28 in the SEC championship game. Arkansas scored 31. I think Arkansas was down like 65-7, and then Bama put in the reserves and they gave up some points. And Oklahoma scored 34, a very similar situation. Alabama dominated that football game, got a huge lead, and then probably let the foot off the gas a little bit gave up some late touchdowns to Heisman Trophy winner Kyler Murray. That's not really that big of a surprise. But in competitive games, yeah, Georgia's right up there with the other teams that are scoring enough points to theoretically beat Alabama if you have a defense. So, like, I'll take that. And then, yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you said. If Kirby's defense is a little bit better in the second half of both of those games, this isn't a problem. That said, Jim Chaney's offense does stall in the second half of both of those games. A lot of offenses stall in the second half against Alabama, or both halves, especially if it's a tight game or you're just outmanned.
I mean, isn't it LSU that hasn't even scored on Alabama? Like,
they did not score last year. I mean, I would say LSU is a pretty talented football team, right? And they scored 10 points 2 years ago, 0 points last year. So LSU, last two matchups against Alabama, is averaging 5 points a game. Jim Chaney, like 25 and a half.
I mean, and obviously Georgia's offense more talented than Tennessee's, but if Pruitt's going to get Tennessee back onto that playing surface, and that playing level, I guess you should say, you know, we expect the recruiting to get players in, and the all your offensive tackles right now are guys Georgia would have wanted on their offensive line. So
Bama would have wanted them.
You know, so there you go.
And then I think with skill players, they're probably going to want to see it, but on recruiting, I mean, Rakeem Jarrett he hasn't decommitted from LSU, but I don't know if you guys saw this. He's taken down all the LSU Tiger stuff from his profiles. That all the Tennessee current commits are tweeting at him saying, hey, let's just go ahead and make it official. Let's go get this thing. You start getting players like Rakeem Jarrett, right? You start getting these 4- and 5-star running backs. The offensive line recruiting continues to be really, really good, despite lack of success on the field to this point. But if you start going getting guys like Derrick Rogers and Justin Hunter, Cordarrelle Patterson, guys like that, yeah, I think I'll take my chances with Jim Chaney over just about anyone. We said this during the coaching search. He was number one on my board. I didn't think it was realistic. I didn't think Tennessee actually had a chance to go steal him from Georgia, especially early on in that process when his name was not being mentioned. But he was the guy I wanted. I mean, we're talking, you know, perfect scenario. You can get anybody you want. Who do you get? Jim Chaney was right at the top of my board, if not number one. And then you went and got him. Not only that, you stole him from your East rival, the top team in the East right now. I don't look at his success or lack thereof in the second half against Alabama and say, nah, man, if only we could have gotten someone else. I mean, who else is there? Like,
no, I think Patrick's right.
Jim Chaney with the right recruiting for a couple of years is one of the best offensive coordinators available in the country at any level.
Well, and I think Chaney is the one guy out there who you have some confidence in, and we feel like is a perfect fit with Jeremy Pruitt. Anybody else was going to be like, I don't know if that's going to work.
Right.
I mean, it might, but it'd be very, a very tenuous, unproven type of question. I mean, and Troy, I think his sentiments are similar. If Pruitt, he says if Pruitt insists on running an archaic offense, Big Jim won't make any difference at all. I'll pause there. I think that the hiring of Jim Chaney signifies the fact that Pruitt realizes he does need to get out of the way of the OC a little bit, and he wants a guy he can trust where he doesn't have to feel like he has to be that involved. Back to Troy's tweet, if he gets out of the way and lets the OC pick the offensive plan and best uses the talent available, we should see a definite improvement. I think that's right. We'll look at how Chaney improved at his previous stops, those offenses, coming up as we kick off hour number three. We'll also get to your phone calls, 865-546-8200 if you want to weigh in. Give us a shout right now as we kick off hour three next.